I hope in some ways, if the number of people who've registered turn up, we might have been struggling to find a theatre big enough. So there are advantages in the bizarre new situation we all find ourselves. Can I make a particular welcome tonight to the many LSE alumni who I know have been invited and are joining us. And amongst those alumni, a special welcome to the graduates of 2020, who as a sort of final cherry on the GradFest cake, which is the GradFest is the sort of substitute graduation that we've had to resort to this year, have had this lecture scheduled. So it was a sort of fortuitous bit of timing, but you're very welcome to join us. Delighted to see so many of you here. And I very much hope that you'll enjoy the event and be able to derive a lot from it. A couple of other administrative announcements before I introduce tonight's guest of honour and speaker. The first is that the lecture is being recorded, which presumably means that in due course it will emerge as a podcast. So those who haven't been able to make it can enjoy it, or those who particularly enjoyed it can come back for a second helping. And the second thing is that when we get to a question and answer session, which hopefully we will have time for, the way to ask questions is to put them in the chat. Almost certainly we won't have a chance to get through all of them. But what I will do is I will go through the chat and relay the questions that seem to fit best to tonight's speaker. Tonight's speaker is David Armitage, who is the Lloyd C. Blankfein Professor of History at Harvard. He's actually joining us not from Harvard, but from Islington. So he's closer to London than I am, because I'm sat in Devon in these strange Zoom orientated times. But David is a very distinguished expert on intellectual and international history and on the junction between the two. His list of books and articles is far too long to go through in any detail, especially as I don't want to take time that would be better spent listening to him. But I will just mention two. One of them was the Ideological History of the British Empire, which was a prize-winning book published in the year 2000. And most recently, The Foundations of Modern International Thought, which was published in 2013. But there's been lots else as well, and he may well refer to that himself. Tonight's talk, though, has the fascinating and intriguing title of Paper Chains or Lilliputian Cords Towards an Intellectual History of Treaties. So without further ado, I will get off your Zoom screen and hand over to David. David, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Piers, for that very warm introduction. I'm sorry we're only meeting in two dimensions, but it's wonderful to have so many people here. As you say, it might be difficult to cram them into a normal lecture room, but it's wonderful to see so many friends. So let me begin with the traditional Zoom ritual of sharing my screen, if I can. And we shall be off to the races. So it's a particular honor, a special honor indeed, to be asked to deliver this annual lecture in the Department of International History at the LSE, to be invited by so many distinguished scholars and old friends who are also distinguished scholars, is both humbling and inspiring, I have to say. I'm inspired especially because this department, among all history departments in the UK and beyond, has made international history its métier for almost 70 years now. It's international in its faculty, it's international in its student body, and of course, it's international in the focus of its teaching and research. Moreover, like the LSE more generally, this department has always been on the cutting edge of defining the international, both among historians, as well as, for example, among international lawyers and students of international relations. It's therefore quite a challenge, I have to admit, to bring something even relatively novel to such a distinguished group. At the very least, one can come here, as I do this evening, to be challenged and to have one's ideas refined. And it's in that spirit that I offer my remarks this evening. Now, my subject is a very traditional one for international historians, perhaps indeed one of the hoariest that one could imagine, treaties. We might say, in fact, that treaties were the stuff of the old international history, the matter of states and their relations, and of pivotal moments in a very traditional conception of international history, marking the ends of wars, the unions of states, or the foundation of international organizations, for instance. The new international history, however, produced in particular on the decades on either side of the turn of the 21st century, largely sidelined treaties in its salutary and transformative quest to mine overlooked archives, to discover marginalized international actors, and to populate the field with novel topics and fresh perspectives. But as so often happens with such movements, there can be a danger of losing the baby along with the bathwater. As we enter a moment of what we might call a new international history, I think it's time now to revisit even some of the most traditional subjects treated by international historians over past decades, even a subject as seemingly traditional as treaties. We can now use fresh eyes and fresh tools derived from the past generation of research. And just because a subject is traditional doesn't mean that it's fully understood or impervious to reconsiderations. In this regard, I can take inspiration from two important recent interventions, both with LSE connections, as it happens. The first is the turn to the material history of international law, pioneered by Jessie Homan and her collaborators in the recent volume, International Law and Its Objects. The contributors to that volume argue that international law is composed not only of norms and cases, laws and customs, but also of things, and constituted by things, from the AIDS virus to whales, by way of such objects as manganese nodules and a treaty canoe from Canada. This volume opens up a truly novel approach to its field by looking for international law in many unexpected places. And it brings international law and the concerns of international lawyers and therefore also of international historians into dialogue with what's been called thing studies in other academic realms, such as the history of consumption or the history of the book, for instance. Also deeply shaped by the story of print and the history of the book and its relationship to law is the second example that you can see here on the screen. That is Linda Colley's very recently published book, The Gun, the Ship and the Pen. Colley shows here how bringing multiple perspectives to a seemingly very familiar archive, in her case, the corpus of written constitutions, can fundamentally transform it. The study of constitutions, of course, was once the traditional bedrock of many history departments, at least in the Anglophone world, but it's long since migrated to schools of law. However, by viewing constitutional history through such lenses as global history, gender history, military history, and the history of print culture, Colley's innovative approach in this really remarkable book may help to bring constitutional history back again into the academic mainstream, refreshed and reviewed. This deft deployment of multiple methodologies in Colley's book is another inspiration for my own current work. That work has a similar ambition to reconsider another body of traditional documents that, qua documents, have moved from the center to the margins of historians' attention in recent generations. Treaties are at once the most widespread and yet I think still in some ways the least understood ligatures of the contemporary international order. When historians have studied treaties, it was often individually or sequentially, not collectively or contextually. An older international history cast as a history of diplomacy strung its narratives along key turning points often marked by treaties, 1648, 1815, 1919, for instance. Then it might reconstruct the negotiation behind those agreements or some of the effects that flowed downstream from them. But it rarely discussed the phenomenon of treaty making or indeed treaty breaking as such, the norms that informed it, the ceremonies that accompanied it, the cultural as well as the political context that shaped it, or the theoretical arguments that explained and justified the practices of treaty making. Nor did that older international history tend to survey how all of those contextual factors changed over time and across space. Now, however, that we're at a moment of rapprochement among historical subfields, as I really think we are, a rapprochement I've just called the new international history, historians can return to treaties again with fresh eyes. For example, the recent anniversaries of the Peace of Utrecht, the Congress of Vienna, and the Versailles treaties have generated rich literatures in recent years, viewing those moments from multiple perspectives, cultural and economic, as well as diplomatic and political, for instance. Meanwhile, historical geographers and students of international relations have begun to study treaties serially, to find patterns, for example, in who were the parties to treaties, where those treaties were signed, and perhaps most revealingly of all, how many treaties, bilateral and multilateral, appeared over time, both in the Western world and then more generally and globally. We also now have a significant number of studies of treaties as events, rather than simply just documents, and of the accompanying representations of them, for example, in art and in music. And the first treatments of the material culture of treaties are beginning to appear, from treatments of the aristocratic prestige objects of the Middle Ages through to the pre-printed treaties deployed in 19th century Africa, for instance, just to quote a couple of distinguished recent articles. One might even say, and I think I would want to say, that we're entering a golden age of treaty history. At just the moment, indeed, and perhaps not coincidentally, when treaties themselves are becoming increasingly salient around the world, from the renegotiation of social contracts in settler colonial societies to the more immediately local travails of Brexit and the Northern Ireland Protocol, for instance. Now, I want to illustrate some of the potential of this turn, or we should perhaps say return, to treaties for my own field, the field of intellectual history. Intellectual historians have taken their own international and global turns in recent years, as Piers has already mentioned. And this has illuminated a whole host of topics, for example, from the genealogies of the global and the international themselves, through to the intellectual histories of such regions as the Middle East and especially South Asia. So far, though, and this is a very broad generalization, so far, though, intellectual historians have proved more comfortable with treatises than with treaties. They, or I should say we, have not yet exploited treaties as resources for intellectual history to any great extent. For example, arguments about treaty making and treaty breaking form a persistent but underappreciated thread within the canon of history political thought, and I'll return to this in just a moment. Many of the canonical figures who produce those arguments, from Machiavelli to Kant and beyond, and again I'll return to them in a second, had long and sometimes lifelong engagements with treaties, which informed their theories and shaped their arguments. And of course, treaties left material and cultural traces as evidence of what we might call more generally treaty consciousness, evidence that is also ripe for historical excavation and investigation. Now, unlike the written constitutions, which Linda Colley has recently brought back into fresh perspective for us, treaties are undoubtedly ancient, going back at least to Mesopotamia. However, more like constitutions, the omnipresence and the efflorescence of treaties is a distinctly modern phenomenon. We can illustrate this with a crude but striking comparison. In 1693, the German philosopher, historian, and princely librarian, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, collected 224 diplomatic agreements in his Codex Juris Gentium Diplomaticus, one of the largest collections of treaties of the late 17th century. By contrast, in 2020, the online United Nations Treaty Collection, the lineal descendant, in fact, of Leibniz's compendium, comprised over 55,000 items going back only to 1945. Again, on this very crude metric, this amounts to a more than 250-fold increase in the number of treaties in a little over 300 years. And that increase was not linear or smooth across the centuries. The pivotal moment came in what the international relations scholar Edward Keane has called the treaty-making revolution of the 19th century, with a sevenfold increase in the number of treaties across that century, and particular spikes in the 1810s, the 1880s, and the 1900s. Indeed, in the last decade of the 18th century, Keane has calculated, 20 to 30 treaties on average were made each year. By 1914, it was around 200 annually. In other words, Keane writes, the making of a new international treaty went from being something that happened perhaps twice a month on average in the late 18th century to something that happened about every other day by the dawn of the First World War. Moreover, it seems to be during the period of acceleration in treaty making, the last third of the 19th century, that the phrase international order first took root. Indeed, the very earliest book I've been able to discover with that title appeared then by the Belgian economist Charles Perrin, L'Ordre International. As Megan Donaldson has also argued, it was during this same moment that a unitary category of treaty emerged among scholars of international law to describe a very wide range of seemingly disparate agreements, which were then collected under a single legal genre. Those international lawyers, of course, had recently professionalized themselves in the 1870s with the formation of the Institut de Droit International, which had given a professional identity to international lawyers for the first time. And I think those three developments, an acceleration in the number of treaties, the professionalization of international law, and the consolidation of a single generic category among lawyers for treaties, that concatenation is not at all coincidental. The treaty-making revolution of the 19th century, in particular of that last third of the 19th century, turned out to be an almost permanent revolution. By 2010, two international relations scholars calculated there were some 3,000 multilateral treaties and 27,000 bilateral treaties in effect around the world. Within a decade of their calculation in 2010 again, that number had doubled to the over 55,000 collected by the United Nations in 2020. International order, we might say, is to a great extent now not just rules-based, but based specifically on the architecture of treaties themselves. Now, just how we all became global Gullivers, tangled in these ties that bind, is a problem that has still been surprisingly little studied by historians, least of all by intellectual historians. My title for tonight's lecture, Paper Chains or Lilliputian Cords, indicates two arguments about treaty making and treaty breaking that I think have an identifiable intellectual history, a little of which I want to share with you now. The first argument might be what could be called the fragility thesis. That is, the argument that treaties are made to be broken, that they're not worth the parchment they're written on, and that they amount to little more than illusory constraints on the parties who make them. The second broad argument is what could be called the robustness thesis. The argument, that is, that treaties are as binding as other contracts, indeed that they can be a model for other social contracts more broadly, and that they do indeed constrain those subject to them, so that it becomes argumentatively imperative to justify treaties and to understand their place within the distribution of power, both domestic and international. These two arguments were developed in dialogue with each other, so that it's slightly artificial to separate them out. But each can be illustrated, I think, with the materials of intellectual history to show some of the places where treaties have been hiding in plain sight, as it were, even in some of the most well-trodden, even perhaps traditional parts of the Western canon. To uncover those arguments, let's go first to the Indian Ocean in the late 17th century. There, in 1699, an English sailor heading for the East Indies was shipwrecked alone, far from his companions. By his own account, he swam ashore and stumbled inland before falling asleep. When he awoke, he reports, "I attempted to rise, but was not able to stir. For as I happened to lie on my back, I found my arms and legs were strongly fastened on each side to the ground, and my hair, which was long and thick, tied down in the same manner. I likewise felt several slender ligatures across my body, from my armpits to my thighs. As the unfortunate traveller roused himself, He had the fortune to break the strings that pinned his arm to the ground and loosen those that bound his hair. His alarmed captors responded with a hail of arrows and by poking him with their spears. This show of force, along with his remaining bonds, kept their captive in order until they could be assured of his gentleness and good behavior. They ultimately set him free, but only after he'd subscribed to a set of articles that circumscribed his movements, and then he signed on to a pact of amity and defense. As of course you'll realize by now, the island, the sailor, and the tormentors were all fictional. The scene, of course, marks the opening of Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels of 1726. There, Lemuel Gulliver finds himself washed up on the island of Lilliput. To the tiny Lilliputians, Gulliver, of course, is a giant, and as such, both a gigantic threat and a colossal opportunity in their battles with their neighbours. First, he had to be constrained. Then he could be engaged. The Colossus was bound by 1,000 tiny strings before entering into an agreement for their mutual benefit. Now, of course, Swift wrote his political satire in the immediate aftermath of the Treaty of Utrecht, which had ended the War of the Spanish Succession. Swift scholars have suggested that a later scene in the book, where Gulliver puts out a fire in the Lilliputian royal palace by pissing on it, alludes to contemporary commentary on that treaty. Indeed, however, as a propagandist for the Peace of Utrecht, both before and after it was negotiated, Swift could convincingly claim, as he wrote in a letter, quotes, to know every step of this treaty better than any man in England. Now, I invoke Gulliver here not as an allegory of the politics of early Georgian Britain, but rather as a metaphor for a great power trammelled by treaties. Each thread that binds Gulliver's limbs or ensnares his hair is weak in itself and easily broken. But taken together as a web or a net enmeshing him from all sides, they prove almost impenetrable. The paradox of the Lilliputian cords became a frequent metaphor for the constraining force of treaties and also the desire of their victims to break free from them. Just to give a couple of examples, for example, in this 1893 satirical print of Uncle Sam as the Gulliver bound down by democratic Lilliputians. A century later, in 1999, the then Clinton administration refused to ratify the statute of the International Criminal Court and stood accused of pulling back from a host of other international agreements, an intimation of what happened in recent years under the Trump administration, of course. At that point, again in 1999, the New York Times ran an op-ed article under the teasing title, Tying Down Gulliver with Those Pesky Treaties. Not for the first time or the last, the American Gulliver was apparently trying to relieve itself from accumulating constraints, as its fictional avatar had done almost 300 years earlier. Gulliver's travails could be reproduced for almost any member of an international society that has agreed to be bound by its agreements. For the most part, the ties that bind them are invisible to most of us, most of the time, like those Lilliputian cords. And also like Gulliver, states, their citizens and other bodies, corporations, international organizations, indeed almost any entity, domestic or international, have become entangled in thousands of treaties. Yet, it was of course not inevitable that this web would spread worldwide, or that it would serve to constrain those caught within it. Notably, the political theory of treaties, as we might call it in the early modern period and the Enlightenment, often assumed that treaties were made to be broken, and that reliance on them would generate only instability. So when in 1914, the German Chancellor Bethmann-Hollweg notoriously called treaties mere scraps of paper, he already had a 400-year tradition of suspicion about treaties behind him. As Niccolo Machiavelli put it in chapter 18 of The Prince, for example, in 1513, plausible reasons could always be found for failure to keep promises. One could give countless modern examples of this and show how many peace treaties and promises have been rendered null and void by the faithlessness of rulers. Of course, Niccolo Machiavelli himself had a rich store of examples on which to draw from his own activities as a Florentine diplomat. Machiavelli's contemporary, Erasmus, agreed with him on this at least, that treaties were a sign not of the faithfulness of princes, but of their faithlessness. Where mutual trust exists, wrote Erasmus in 1516, and business is being done between honest men, there is no need for a lot of these niggling bits of paper. To make treaties at all was a sign that princes did not trust each other sufficiently. Almost two centuries later, Leibniz agreed in the preface to his Codex Juris Gentium that we've already seen. Today, in truth, Leibniz wrote, we would not be wrong in many cases to say that rulers play cards in private life and with treaties in public affairs. Leibniz suspected that some of his readers might think it odd for the editor of a collection of treaties to discourse on the weakness of what he called such paper chains. However, he protested in quite Machiavellian tones, he had to describe things as they are, not as we would like them to be. And it was in this same spirit, in that same introduction, that Leibniz related a dry Dutch joke in which a fashionable wit put up a house sign with the title Perpetual Peace. The picture beneath it was a picture of a graveyard. Evidently, the only truly eternal peace, according to Leibniz, was the sleep of the dead. Now, Leibniz's apprehension that a plea of necessity or reason of state, as it was more generally called, could justify the breach of a treaty was widely shared in Enlightenment Europe. I'll just give a couple of examples among many. For example, David Hume, in his Inquiry Concerning the Principles of Morals in 1751, argued that all politicians will allow, and most philosophers, that reason of state may, in particular emergencies, dispense with the rules of justice and invalidate any treaty or alliance where the strict observance of it would be prejudicial in a considerable degree to either of the contracting parties. It seems clear that Lord Frost and Boris Johnson and others may have been reading David Hume lately. In a similar vein, that paradigm of enlightened rulership, Frederick the Great, forewarned the reader in the preface to his History of My Age, 1746, so slightly before Hume, that she would see during the course of this work, treaties made and treaties broken. The safety of a ruler's subjects had to take precedence over the sanctity of agreements, Frederick argued. It would therefore be better that the sovereign repudiate a treaty rather than let his people perish. This calculus of realpolitik may have made some sense to a prince like Frederick, but to more critical publics, it simply nourished the view that monarchs were unethical and untrustworthy, and their agreements, their treaties, were hardly worth the parchment they were written on or the paper they were printed on. That they were, in Leibniz's words, no more than paper chains, not even the slender Lilliputian cords that restrained the giant Gulliver. For a more positive and penetrating construction of treaties, we can turn back a few decades to a near contemporary of Leibniz and indeed of Lemuel Gulliver, John Locke. Locke's entanglement with treaties was both consistent and varied from the 1650s until his death almost 50 years later. This engagement derived in part from his responsibilities as a client of the English aristocrat, Anthony Ashley Cooper, later 1st Earl of Shaftesbury, and in the latter part of his career as an administrator in the governments of Charles II and especially of William III. In these roles, Locke had to be aware of the provisions of relevant international treaties and of their implications for the sovereigns, the peoples, and the territories with which he dealt. Among those sovereigns were not just states, but also indigenous peoples and commercial corporations. An important reminder that the decades after 1648, the decades of Locke's own maturity and public activity, were not a so-called Westphalian world of mutually recognizing and hard-edged independent sovereign states, but a much more variegated landscape of sovereign entities, South and Southeast Asian rulers and North American sachems, corporations and federations, all held sovereignty, all made agreements with each other in this period. Making treaties was one of the most obvious marks of sovereignty, as Locke well knew from experience and from his own wide reading. Locke's consciousness of treaties, in fact, went back to the very beginning of his public career. Indeed, his very first appearance in print at the age of 22 was marked by two poems, one in Latin, one in English, celebrating Cromwell's Treaty of Westminster with the Netherlands that ended the First Anglo-Dutch War in 1654. And this was, in fact, not just Locke's publishing debut, it was also the very first collection of poems published in Britain to commemorate a treaty. That commemorative volume, therefore, was evidence of a newly emergent consciousness of treaties in the mid-17th century, as that consciousness intersected with burgeoning print culture. Locke's own lifetime, from the 1630s to the first decade of the 18th century, coincided almost exactly with the decades in which treaty consciousness became widespread across Europe. Treaties, as I've just mentioned, benefited immensely from the media revolution of this period, but not just in terms of printed words. Cheap prints began to appear, for example, depicting for the first time scenes of the signature, the ratification, and the celebration of treaties. These were often based on the new genre of treaty paintings, which also began to burgeon in the early 17th century. And new forms of commemoration and celebration, such as treaty music, composed to mark the negotiation or the conclusion of treaties, also began to burgeon in the late 17th century. This was the period that also saw the first emergence of more formal training for young diplomats in the fundamentals of the laws of nations and the skills needed for effective negotiation and treaty making. As Locke himself noted in his thoughts concerning education in 1693, a virtuous and well-behaved young man that is well-versed in the general part of the civil law, which concerns not the chicane of private cases, but the affairs and intercourse of civilized nations in general, grounded upon principles of reason, should understand Latin well and write a good hand. And such a gentleman may turn loose into the world with great reassurance that he will find employment and esteem everywhere, particularly, of course, in the diplomatic corps of his own particular state. Such an investment in the knowledge of the affairs and intercourse of civilized nations, as Locke put it, had indeed become indispensable by this time. And indeed, Locke himself in his own life exemplified that tendency by reading and acquiring collections of treaties for his own information. The modern genre of treaty collections had begun in the 1640s when Locke was only in his teens. And it peaked, in Britain at least, with the publication of Thomas Rymer's 14-volume compendium, The Foiderer, published in the year of Locke's death, 1704, by Locke's own publishers, Ormsby and John Churchill in London. Locke was both an early adopter of these novel media and an intermittent consumer of them. Collecting and reading treaties informed both his practical activities as an administrator and his theoretical reflections as a political philosopher. During the 1660s, Locke had been what we might call a minor treaty broker, in fact, an agent and intermediary in the traffic in treaties that had been growing in Europe since the 1640s. He spent a few months as a diplomatic secretary to the English envoy in Cleves, Sir Walter Vane, in the early 1660s. And while there, he found a copy of one of the earliest treaty compilations, the Theatrum Pacis of 1663. And later, he continued to dabble in the treaty trade. For example, when traveling in France in the 1670s, Locke heard that copies of the very scarce and voluminous treaties between England and other countries were hard to find, and his correspondent tasked him with winkling out some continental compendia, which he could send back to friends in England. In the 1680s, while he was in exile in Holland, Locke would have had access to other treaty compendia in the library of his friend, the Quaker merchant Benjamin Furley. And in the latter years of his life back in England, Locke collected treaties for his own personal library. As the editor of one of the most popular treaty collections, the French historian Amelot de la Houssaye noted in his Preliminaries of Treaties published in 1697, "There are many thousand passages in history which are never rightly understood for want of being acquainted with the treaties on which they are grounded." Locke himself would surely have agreed, and he bought a copy of Amelot de la Houssaye's book for his own collection. As a political actor, Locke was persistently conscious of and engaged with treaties and their salience in the international media environment of his time. His administrative duties, particularly with regard to English colonies and commerce, would have brought home to him the truth of De La Houssaye's observation. In his capacities as Secretary of the Board of Trade and Plantations in the 1670s, and later as a member of the Williamite Board of Trade in the 1690s, Locke regularly dealt with treaty provisions, such as claims to colonial possession, territorial agreements, and commercial disputes. For example, in 1673, during his time on the first English Board of Trade and Plantations, he was involved in debates regarding the English right to cut logwood in the Yucatan in Central America, which had been regulated under the terms of the Anglo-Spanish Treaty of 1670. Succeeding years, Locke became the point man for the Council's deliberations about the provisions of the 1674 Anglo-Dutch Treaty of Westminster relating to Suriname, and also for a project of a Portugal treaty, as it was called, to renegotiate England's commercial relations with Portugal. 20 years later, at the end of his career, as a more powerfully independent secretary to the Board of Trade, he would recommend, for example, that the powers of Europe enter into a multilateral treaty to combat the international scourge of piracy. The picture we have, therefore, of Locke in these years is of an efficient, discreet, bureaucratic operator, trusted by his superiors to conduct sensitive business, and especially skilled in the matter of treaties and their application. Now, Locke's interest in treaties was not confined to Europe and European powers. As a colonial administrator for the proprietors of Carolina in the 1660s and early 1670s, he'd become well aware that indigenous peoples in the Americas engaged in diplomacy and that they expressed their sovereignty and equality with other sovereigns by making treaties. In 1669, the proprietors of Carolina produced a frame of government for their colony, the so-called Fundamental Constitutions of Carolina. And as secretary to the proprietors, Locke was said to have had a great hand in its original composition, and he was involved again in 1682 in revising the document. Strikingly, those fundamental constitutions twice acknowledge the autonomy of the natives of Carolina, the first for the protection of their religious liberty and the diversity of their beliefs, the second, crucially, for their capacity to enter into agreements among sovereigns, agreements enumerated in state matters, dispatches, and treaties with the neighbor Indians, and the ability, as the constitutions put it, of any of the neighbor Indians of the English colony to make war, to make leagues, and to make treaties. The Native Americans of Carolina expressed that sovereignty in the same way as European sovereigns, by waging war, by joining alliances, and by making treaties. For Locke, indigenous peoples evidently possessed the capacity for treaty making and for being held to their contracts, just as Europeans would be held to their treaties with indigenous peoples. They were recognizable to European sovereigns as equal parties in contractual relationships, especially if they were reliable in their dealings with their treaty partners. Now, Locke's bureaucratic experiences and his immersion in contemporary travel literature informed his novel accounts of the social contract and the division of powers in his mature political thought, especially in the two treatises of government. In the second of those treatises, Locke's account of the social contract as emerging from a state of nature depended on the ability of free, equal, and independent natural persons to make agreements with one another. If that were not possible, Locke argued, it would be inconceivable that they could escape any state of nature to create a functioning commonwealth, because that could only be done by, as he put it, agreeing with other men to join and unite into a community. The capacity for making agreements was in this way a function of the pre-civil state of nature that was carried over into civil society. Locke's commitment to the continuity of that capacity justified his novel and unprecedented account of the division of powers in chapter 12 of the second treatise, entitled Of the Legislative, Executive, and Federative Power. Locke knew that his proposed tripartite division of powers was unusual, not just for its division, but also because the third of those powers was what he called the federative, that is literally the capacity to enter into external agreements, or in Latin, foedera, the plural of foedus, treaty, agreement, or contract. What exactly was that federative power according to Locke? He gave that definition, and it's here at the bottom of the right-hand page reproduced on the screen. It's the power of war and peace, leagues and alliances, and all the transactions with all persons and communities without, that is outside the Commonwealth, and this may be called the federative, if anyone pleases. So the thing be understood, I'm indifferent as to the name. Locke knew his division of powers was unusual because he had to coin a political neologism to describe it. The federative power was, for Locke, one of those capacities that carried over from the state of nature into civil society. However, it still accorded closely with specifically English constitutional theory and the division of powers between Crown and Parliament in the late 17th century. However, Locke's account of the federative power was not only an empirical description of the prerogatives of the English Crown before and after the Glorious Revolution. It also implied a normative relationship between the social contract created by individuals, which brought them out of the state of nature, and the expanding network of agreements made by what he called several communities around the globe, variously to determine states of peace and war among themselves, to forge alliances and to settle the bounds of their distinct territories by compact and agreement. There was nonetheless a major difference between the social contract and the agreements made between sovereigns, Locke went on. For it is not every compact that puts an end to the state of nature between men, but only this one of agreeing together mutually to enter into one community and to make one body politic. Other promises and compacts men may make with one another and yet still be in the state of nature. Treaties for Locke were therefore like individual contracts. They may have bound individuals to each other for particular purposes, but they left them still in an international state of nature with regard to one another. That international realm remained as a state of nature in which sovereigns could not execute a global social contract to create a global commonwealth, ruling over all peoples, sovereigns, corporations, and other bodies capable of making specific agreements, treaties, with one another. Now, looking at the reception of Locke's account, we can see that his particular conception of the federative power fell on stony ground. It attracted almost no contemporary discussion. It did not catch on with other similar tripartite discussions of the division of powers, and his very neologism federative was forgotten, at least in the precise sense that he used it, to be replaced by Montesquieu's reinvention of the term in his description of what he called the federative republic, the République Fédérative, in his Esprit des Lois of 1748. Yet, consideration of Locke's federative may be worth resurrection, as other scholars, including Thomas Poole of the LSE, have recently done, as a reminder that in the hands of its inventor, it denoted a more expansive capacity for autonomous and binding interaction than its later users might have acknowledged, encompassing the actions of indigenous peoples and corporations, as well as those of self-identified modern or civilized actors like states. Locke's conception of the federative arose from a particular moment in the intellectual history of treaties, when consciousness of them in Europe was as strong as treaty consciousness beyond it, and when an engaged and sympathetic observer such as Locke could elevate treaty making among the leading marks of sovereignty, if not in fact its most durable and characteristic expression. Finally, the Lockean origins of the federative power in the tradition of treaty making may be a salutary reminder of the importance of treaties as a resource for intellectual history. For, as one of Locke's greatest continental admirers, Emma de Vattel, asserted in the mid-18th century, the subject of treaties is undoubtedly one of the most important that the mutual relations and affairs of nations can present us with. I'll conclude with another astute observer of treaties, who continued the contractual or federal tradition within which Locke and Vattel had written, that is, with Immanuel Kant. Kant was not just shrewd, but playful in his interest in treaties. Now, of course, I'm fully aware that the words playfulness and Kant are not often found in the same sentence, but bear with me for a moment. I believe that his now very famous pamphlet, Zum ewigen Frieden, Toward Perpetual Peace of 1795, contained layers of jokes which would have been picked up by his observant readers in the 1790s. Any of them familiar with the texts of 17th and 18th century European peace treaties and with the contemporary literature of the Law of Nations would have recognized Kant's own title as an allusion to the frequent stipulation in those treaties that their purpose was to secure perpetual peace. However, Vattel had earlier noted that this did not mean that they promised never to make war on each other for any causes whatsoever, only that they wouldn't revive the same causes of war in future. It was exactly that kind of casuistry that led Kant to include Vattel in the roster of what he called the pitiful comforters, those towering contemporary authorities on the Law of Nations, supposedly towering ones, whom princes often cited to justify their wars, but whose testimony had, Kant said, never prevented any conflicts in contemporary Europe. He was, of course, thinking about his own former sovereign, Frederick the Great, among the greatest violators of treaties by appealing to necessity and reason of state. Now, readers who caught the first in-joke in Kant's title were rewarded with a second, as Kant opened his essay by explaining his title toward perpetual peace with an obvious allusion to Leibniz. It may be left undecided whether the satirical inscription on a certain Dutch innkeeper's signboard picturing a graveyard, perpetual peace, was to hold for human beings in general or for heads of state in particular. Heads of state who could never get enough of war, or does that idea only hold for philosophers who dream that sweet dream of perpetual peace? And even readers who didn't get the allusions to Leibniz and Vattel would soon notice that Kant had cast his entire treatise in the form of a treaty, complete with 6 preliminary articles for perpetual peace among states, 3 definitive articles, and 2 supplements, in the second edition at least, one of them treating the vexed subject of secret articles in treaties for perpetual peace. The inspiration for Kant's treatise on treaties is usually held to be the Treaty of Basel, concluded between Prussia and France in April 1795, and this agreement may indeed have been the initial spark to his imagination. However, as the strata of textual and generic allusions suggest, Kant was more concerned with the whole European international order and its underpinnings, and indeed with the media revolution in the distribution and the reception of treaties that had taken place in the 100 years or so before he wrote. The only definitive means of securing perpetual peace, Kant argued, would be for the civil constitution of every state to be based on the autonomous consent of its citizens, who would be likely to veto needless wars if the activities of princes and of republics and of republics were made truly public. The resulting republics, as Kant called them very specifically, would have to be conjoined in a federation, that is linked by agreements among themselves, retaining their individual autonomy, not constituting a world state. And they would be under what he called a regime of cosmopolitan right, tempered by a duty of hospitality towards visitors from outside. Taken together, the various terms of Kant's treaty, a social contract in effect between populations and their rulers, would lead gradually but asymptotically towards perpetual peace. Unlike what, and here I quote him, unlike what have till now falsely been called peace treaties, but which are strictly speaking truces. With generic wit and ample allusion, Kant argued for the possibility of truly perpetual peace based on scaling up his conception of autonomy from individuals to states and to the voluntary community, the voluntary federal community they would create among themselves. This would be a solution to what he would have diagnosed as crises in his own contemporary international order: predatory princes, dependent populations, the militarization of society, hardening borders, and the proliferating pathologies of empire across the globe. But Kant also made clear that perpetual peace need not only entail the sleep of death. A year later, in a follow-up pamphlet entitled The Proclamation of the Imminent Conclusion of a Treaty of Perpetual Peace in Philosophy, a much less well-known work, here he played his serious joke out to its conclusion. In this brief and often overlooked work, Kant defended his own critical philosophy as, quotes, an outlook always armed, which, precisely because of this, accompanies the activity of reason and offers the prospect of eternal peace among philosophers. This would be the foundation for what Kant saw as a true peace treaty, based on mutual understanding of the part among the parties and thereby declared settled, or at least near to settlement. Now, Kant's witty manipulation of a century of European treaty culture exposed the danger for treaties, particularly from princely politics and captious philosophers, and also the imperatives of modern state building. And he revealed the dangers posed by treaties themselves if they were too naively held to be structural elements of international order. Kant's Perpetual Peace, his first work of 1795 at least, found a new life in the aftermath of the First World War, at a moment when peace groups, federalist societies, and supporters of the nascent League of Nations canonized the work as a blueprint for a new international order and for attempts to end war after that war, supposedly to end all wars. The second supplement to Kant's fictive treaty had argued in favor of publicity and against what he calls secret articles in negotiations of public right. And this, of course, appeared as the very first of the 14 points US President Woodrow Wilson promulgated in early 1918 as the guide for the coming peace. Open covenants of peace, openly arrived at, after which there shall be no private international understandings of any kind, but diplomacy shall proceed always frankly and in the public view. Wilson's Kantian concern led in due course to a norm of treaty publication being inserted into the covenant of the League of Nations in 1920. This demanded that treaties only come into force when they were registered with the League and subsequently published, as an institutional answer to the problem of political duplicity that Kant had brought out into the open. And that article mutated, that article of the covenant mutated in due course to the expectation after 1948 that all such agreements, such treaties, would be registered with the United Nations under Article 102 of the UN Charter. Hence, this leads directly to the UN treaty database of today. Now, as I hope these brief examples might show, the intellectual history of treaties, even just in the global north, which is where I confine myself for this brief talk, is not a teleological story, but a much more tangled narrative of fits and starts, extinctions and innovations, arguments with legs, like Kant's for the publication of treaties, and ideas without much of a future, like Locke's conception of the federative. But I also hope I've suggested that a merely textual history of treaties is nonetheless insufficient. That history also needs to be contextual in the sense of taking account of material conditions, the physical forms in which ideas and documents circulate, the feedback between formal and informal genres, and the links between cultural and intellectual productions. I mentioned earlier that I think we might be entering a golden age of treaty history. If we are, it's surely in part because we're all so much more conscious of treaties than at any other time in recent history. The Brexit negotiations, UK withdrawal from the EU, and the messy aftermath of these events, up to and including the recent threats to violate international law in relation to the Northern Ireland Protocol, have made treaty and their provisions, such as Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, under which the UK withdrew from the EU, these have become remarkably and perhaps unpredictably, the stuff of headlines, at least in Britain, and more strikingly so than any point in recent memory, except perhaps for the Maastricht moment now 3 decades ago. The Trump administration's consistent and persistent assault on specific treaties, from the Paris Agreement on Climate Change to the International Arms Trade Treaty and a host of other international agreements in between, and thereby its assault on the entire architecture of the treaty-based international order, raised global concerns in recent years about treaties even further. And last but certainly not least, the movement for indigenous peoples to renegotiate their positions within settler colonial societies, most conspicuously, but not only in Australia, with a desire for a renegotiation on the basis of a treaty, has brought the internal force of treaties to the fore in contemporary discussions, alongside the international effects of treaties as well. At such a moment, I think it's the case that treaties are simply too important to be left solely to scholars of international law and international relations. International and intellectual historians should also be on hand to treat treaties as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you for a very wide-ranging and fascinating talk. I deal with quite a few treaties myself at the sort of in the 20th century end of history, but it's fascinating to venture far further back. So many thanks for that. We have a little bit of time remaining for questions. As I said earlier, I think the best way of doing this is for people to write them down in the chat, and I will relay them to David. I know that that's frustrating for those of you who like talking, but given that we have a limited time, I think that's probably the most efficient way of using it. And I have a first question already come in from my colleague David Motterdell, who asks whether you can say a bit more about the role of the non-European role in your story. Most of your examples are European, but international treaties and ideas about treaties also shaped relations between European and non-European states, particularly those states that retained their independence in the imperial age. How were treaties conceptualized in states like China, Japan, Persia, Siam, Abyssinia, etc.? So, can we come back to the first question?
Yes. Thank you, David, for a wonderful and entirely expected question to broaden and deepen the range of a talk, which I deliberately confined
Sorry to interrupt very briefly. Okay. I mean, there's a second part of the question, which is really the most important part. There was something like if we see something like a universal notion of the concept of treaty during the 18th and 19th century, something that connected the worlds.
Yes, that's wonderful, and a very important second part as well. Thank you for both parts of that, David. I think one of the things that we can see by again the latter part of the 19th century, partly because of the diffusion and translation and reception of initially Western, or we might say Atlantic or Northern texts of international law, is a convergence among those states which wish to be treated as sovereigns in mutual relations, both with each other, say in the broad Asian sphere, or with other European and American powers, on conceptions of what we might call very broadly pacta sunt servanda. There are commentators at that time and since who say that one of the few genuine universals in world history is the idea of pacta sunt servanda. I think that's a self-serving conception, one that has its own history that would be worth tracing on its own. When does that idea of the universality of pacta sunt servanda emerge? I've tried to suggest it's certainly not universal among even European thinkers in the period up to the mid-19th century, at least. But that convergence on the idea that treaties must be entered into freely, that they should be the parties to them should be held equally liable, that they create binding obligations. This comes to create a set of norms which I think become transcultural, probably in that same moment after and during the treaty revolution. Now, what we need, and maybe you and I and others on this call, David, can put together, is a conference and a collective volume, or maybe a multi-volume set, precisely on exactly the answers to your questions. What were the intellectual histories of treaties and other similar forms of contractual agreement in the various regions and areas and state systems and international orders or suborders that you've named? I think that would be a wonderful collective project, one well beyond my powers, but probably not yours, I imagine, but one that we should definitely try and convene at some point. But I was just trying to suggest some of the possibilities here, but I'm quite sure there are others, not least on this call, who could provide us with some concrete pathways towards even better answers to those very important questions.
it's always good to hear new volumes emerging as we speak, but that sounds a fascinating one. Okay, can I, the next question is actually picking you up on Pacta Sunt Servanda, and so my colleague Beatrice Heuser now in Glasgow asked, were more thinkers you studied persuaded that Pacta Sunt Servanda, or that they could be broken? So sort of was that a majority view in the period that you're talking about?
I'm not sure I've done a Zoom poll of all available thinkers for that. But I think the general tendency, and maybe I should have accentuated this a little more in the talk, the general tendency is a decline, probably in the long aftermath of the Congress of Vienna and the Congress system, at least among European thinkers, a decline of that sense of treaties as being fragile and fungible according to the dictates of reason of state, in an order dominated by a handful of relatively untrustworthy princes. I think it was much more sustainable and much more frequently argued that princes' agreements were like playing cards or paper chains, as I quoted Leibniz and Hume and indeed Frederick the Great saying. There are perhaps fewer testimonies of that, though Bethmann-Hollweg, who I quoted that famous quotation from 1914, was certainly a residue of that skepticism about treaties. And maybe the Trump administration's activities in recent years, or the one can find Donald Rumsfeld saying very similar things in some of his snowflake memos about treaties. Even the Clinton administration in the 1990s had a similar attitude towards the fragility of treaties, but this is an area where the overlap or the lack of overlap between emergent international legal norms on the one hand, and then the practices of politicians and statespeople on the other, perhaps becomes more evident. But that too has a history which has only been imperfectly traced. But I'm laying down, putting up some flares, as it were, into the darkness to try and illuminate places where we might look for that that dance between these arguments. But thank you for that prompt.
I then have a question about your sort of methodology from Benjamin Martin of Uppsala University. You quipped that intellectual historians tend to prefer treatises to treaties, mm-hmm. but then indeed spend most of your time talking about treatises. Mm-hmm. Will treaty texts themselves play an important part in your project?
Yes, indeed, not least inspired by your own work, Ben, on cultural treaties, which I think is one of the best models that we now have for the serial consideration of large corpora of treaties. We need because so many bodies of treaty materials like the cultural treaties you're studying at the moment are now available electronically and serially. They can be text mined and data mined. So I think we have a great set of resources here for conceptual history, not least, which have been under exploited. I don't have the tools, literal or figurative, to do that, but I know that, of course, you and others are beginning to exploit those materials. So I think that is, as we see a moment of the convergence between data-driven history, textual history based on large textual corpora, and the treatment of treaties and intellectual history, sitting at that intersection, I think we have a very large and very fertile body of material which can be treated in exactly that way. So I would refer everybody again on this call to Ben's work for one very important pointer towards the methods for doing exactly that.
Okay, then I then have a question from Harold Aaron saying, was there such a thing as a first modern style treaty? Was the Treaty of Utrecht perhaps the starting signal?
Well, it all depends what you mean by modern treaty. I wouldn't dare to venture that. What is interesting, of course, are the various narratives which are constructed around the imagination or the location of such an originary moment. The most notorious, of course, being 1648 as precisely that moment, and there are various narratives, quite late-breaking narratives, many coming from the early 19th century, where 1648 provides a moment. But in some of the treaty collections, as you may be aware of the 18th century, it is indeed Utrecht which comes to mark precisely that starting point as a bilateral treaty among a multitude of European powers, not simply within or around the fringes of the Holy Roman Empire, for instance, created at a treaty congress, and of course, publicized and materialized through treaty paintings, treaty music, treaty ceremonies, all the things that become characteristic, at least, but not only in the European arena, as treaty moments or treaty events. So perhaps Utrecht could stand proxy for one narrative of the emergence of modern treaties, but other constructions of what a treaty is and how it functions might look very different, and might in some hands, for instance, only go back to the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, for instance, which stabilizes the meaning and the form of a treaty as something that, for instance, has to be written and made public only in the 1950s. So there might be an even more modern construction of treaties to accompany the emergence of what some international historians have seen as the emergence of a truly modern world of states that is only the era of decolonization. But we can create those multiple narratives and, of modernity, and therefore multiple starting points for it, perhaps tied to particular treaties or treaty forming processes.
Got questions flooding in here, so I'm not going to be able to do justice to them all, I'm afraid, but let me pick out just a couple. One from my former colleague and friend Sujit Sivasundaram, saying, following David Motterdell's question, how do alternative conceptions or even rituals of agreement factor into the transcultural history of the treaty? Given your interest in the Pacific, David, I wonder about notions of ceremonial friendship, which could bind and even involve the plaiting of hair between friends, Europeans and Pacific. Indeed, maybe there is an even wider history of the Lilliput story.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think there is absolutely. We could talk a great deal about the chronologies as well as the, as it were, the spatiality of treaty making in the Pacific, and the parties who were held to treaties and the reasons why those treaties were promulgated and what they indicated about both indigenous and non-indigenous conceptions of sovereignty. Precisely, you're right about those ceremonies as well. One can parallel those with the treaty ceremonies or the contractual ceremonies in North America, for instance, with gift exchanges, the exchange of bonds of friendship through physical signs, through smoking, through embracing. And it's interesting that even the European iconography of treaty making going back to the mid 17th century is often thoroughly transcultural in the way in which it imagines treaty making, and uses quite traditional within the Mediterranean context, quite traditional signs of treaty making, such as the treaty kiss, as something which becomes transcultural, even from a European point of view. And I think what's one of the things that's significant about that is how translatable were the various forms of agreement, precisely of embracing, of gift giving, of the exchange of material forms of treaties, as well as, and interwoven, not literally interwoven, as you say, with the terms of treaty agreements themselves. So that intercultural translatability of treaty forms, treaty ceremonies, I think is something on which we have multiple literatures now, but they haven't been pulled together into a fully global account. So that's something else we can feed into the now enormous series of conferences and volumes that we're all collectively beginning to plan here this evening.
Thank you. A final question, perhaps, although, as I say, I must apologise to the large number of people who've written questions I won't have time to get to, but I think we said that we'd try and finish at 2:15, so it's probably best to make this the last question. Matthias Hammer asks, I was wondering whether you could speak more about one specific type of interstate declaration, namely declarations of war. Yeah. Which became institutionalized by the late 19th century in the Hague Conventions, but have rather fallen by the wayside. I'm curious if the thinkers you look at consider declarations of war specifically in relations to issues of publicity or international law.
Yes, absolutely. Now, that's a very interesting question. Precisely as you imply, that declarations of war have effectively entirely disappeared as international documents, as expected public acts. As you will well know, if you go back to the 18th century, declarations of war were often accompanied by a multitude of other documents, like the genre of the manifesto, for instance, famously, of course, picked up and transmogrified by Marx and Engels, was originally the justificatory argument or set of arguments, printed arguments that went alongside a declaration of war, which tended to be rather skeletal. So you see a proliferation of intersecting public genre, often printed genre, around declarations of war, which gradually detach from each other, get transmuted, and then even declarations of war disappear. In parallel to that, of course, the interesting parallel to that in relation to treaties is the almost the near decline of peace treaties to end wars, except civil wars. Since 1989, the proliferation of peace treaties has happened almost entirely in relation to civil conflict, something I touched on in my last book on civil war. So the shifting landscape and morphology, the evolution and the extinction of different forms of treaty is something in which I'm very interested in, of course, exactly how those intersect with other parallel forms of public document or documents which are expected to be made public. That's all part of that the ecological environment, which the ecology, the international ecology, which needs to be reconstructed to understand the spread, the rise, decline, fall, reception of treaties in their various different understandings across modern and indeed perhaps pre-modern history as well.
I think we should end there, but I think the number of questions asked, including the many that I didn't have a chance to put to you, sort of are a good testament to how fascinating the talk has been and how rich the subject area that you're moving into is. And so I look forward very much to hearing more from you on this subject and to see the appearance in print of all of those volumes that we've had appearing virtually, at least before our eyes this evening. Many thanks, David. Many thanks also to all of those of you who have attended. It's been a lovely event. I'm only sad that we can't now adjourn to a neighbouring pub or hostelry for some food and drink, but I think some of us will go downstairs and do that very shortly. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And I'm saving the chat. I'll probably be in touch with some of you about your marvellous questions, which we didn't have a chance to talk to.
That's an excellent idea. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Piers. Thank you, everyone.
Well, thank you. Bye.
Bye.